You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com.
Hey, guys and gals, welcome to the Oklahoma Outdoors Podcast, brought to you by Arrowhead Land Company. Here you will be educated, entertained, and equipped to get more out of your outdoor experience. So hold on tight, because here we go. Hey everybody, welcome to the show. This is the Oklahoma Outdoors Podcast, and I hope you guys are doing fantastic. I am feeling so much better this week. I was really, really struggling last week. I apologize again for the, just the lack of quality for last week's episode, but I'm pretty sure I had COVID. I didn't actually go get tested or anything, but I had the cold symptoms. I was sore. I didn't have any energy. I didn't think COVID was a thing anymore. But yeah, I was really struggling last week, and then, you know, my wife was out of town, so I didn't have anybody to take care of me, much less my daughter. I was having to chase a toddler around while feeling, you know, so bad and everything. So it was just a really rough week, but feeling much better this week, and I promise you this week's episode's gonna make up for last week's, because we have a really, really good one. We're talking to our old friend Tyrell Roy. He's been on the show several times, and I always look forward to having him on. And so, like I said, we got a really, really good one this week. But before we get there, want to talk a little bit about application season, because we are diving headfirst into it right now. I got my spreadsheet that I keep up right here in front of me, and so we'll go through that real quick. Colorado is currently open, and so I already got my deer and elk points for that. Utah just opened, and so I got a limited entry deer, a general deer, and an elk point there. I just learned this last night, so there's the two different deer points, and basically they have all the different units in Utah split up into essentially trophy units and just regular units, and they actually have separate points for both of those. I didn't know that. That's why I only have the one point for the general. And so limited entry, that's like the good stuff, you know, 200 inch deer type thing. And then the general is kind of just more the opportunity stuff. Lot more tags, but also a lot more pressure, not the quality of animals. But I went ahead and got one of those points because, you know, maybe I'll save up like 3 or 4 points or something like that and get like a half decent unit. And then I'm saving my limited entry, you know, that's going to be like maybe the 10 point plus when I'm in my 40s and everything. So yeah, Utah's open. New Mexico applications are open. New Mexico does not have a point system. I applied for the first time ever this year. And if I'm being completely honest with you, I don't think I have time to go hunt in New Mexico this year. But I went ahead and applied. And I basically just applied for like really, really good units that have really low odds of drawing, because I don't really expect to draw, so I'm not like counting on it. But if I did draw, it would be the type of hunt that, like, you know, I would drop other things to go hunt there. So yeah, that was kind of my strategy there. So yeah, that's open. Let's see here. Montana and Wyoming, I think they're either open or about to open. If you're actually applying, if you're just getting a preference point, that's not till this summer in July. Excuse me. I think Idaho applications open soon. They also do not have a point system, although I heard that I think in 26 they are going to implement their first ever point system, because there's just too many people trying to go there now. Iowa's later on. Texas is later on. Oklahoma will be opening soon, so you can put in for the controlled hunts there. And then Kansas. So I'm going to talk about Kansas for a second, because, spoiler alert, I am actually applying to hunt there this year. So I bought my first Kansas point, I believe, 6 years ago. And at that time, it was kind of hit and miss on whether you needed a point or not. There were still several units that you could draw with 0 points. Some of the better units, you needed 1 point. And so I bought a point a couple years ago, and I've just never been able to go. Like, I've always had some other trip or, you know, not enough vacation time, whatever. Just haven't made time for it. But this year, well, so hold on, not quite done there. So one other thing about Kansas is if you do not use your point within 5 years, it expires. Basically, they just think you know, you're never going to go. So last year, to keep my point from expiring, I bought a second point. And so I'm probably one of the few people out there in this country that have two Kansas points, because like I said, you typically just need one. And so back to the spoiler alert, I plan to hunt Kansas this year. And the application, I think they open April 1st, so coming up here quick. And I'm trying to figure out my strategy. And I would love some help on this if any of you out there have hunted Kansas. My goal is I really want to hunt mule deer. I've talked about how I'm trying to make this year the year of the mule deer. And so several of the units on the western side of Kansas, you can apply for, you know, a mule deer tag. And the way it works is you first have to apply for a whitetail tag. And so you apply for that. And then if you draw that, you then go into the bucket for a mule deer tag. And so with my 2 points, I'm basically 100% guaranteed to draw. I mean, most of the units now are 100% with 1 point. I have 2 points. So there really shouldn't be a question if I can draw a whitetail tag. But then, like I said, you go into the pot for the mule deer tag. And I think the highest odds of all the units is like 26%. So I only have like a 1 in 4 chance of actually drawing a mule deer tag. So what I'm trying to figure out right now is, do I want to, you know, put in for a good mule deer unit that may not have as good of whitetails? Or do I want to kind of, you know, go somewhere in the middle? Because like I said, there's a better chance that I'll end up with a whitetail tag. So I don't know if I want to end up in a bad whitetail unit, if there are such thing in Kansas. So yeah, that's what I'm trying to go with now. You do get to pick one additional unit that touches your unit. So just as an example, 1 and 2 touch. And so I could put in for the tag for unit 1 and then put, you know, unit 2 is my little secondary thing. So if I draw, I get to hunt both of those units. And so I'm thinking about maybe picking 2 units that touch each other east and west. So that way, you know, if I get the mule deer tag, I have kind of that more western unit. If I don't draw it, I can move a little bit further east that, you know, you're going to think you're going to have better whitetails there. So, excuse me again. So that's kind of what I'm leaning towards right now. But like I said, if you're more familiar with Kansas than I am, I've never hunted up there, shoot me a message or email me, whatever. OKOutdoorsPodcast@gmail.com is the email, Instagram, Facebook, all that good stuff. And let me know what you guys think. As of right now, the plan is I think I'm going to try to do Kansas instead of Nebraska, like I've done the last 2 years. I didn't mention that. They have a early September muzzleloader season, and I think that's what I'm going to go for. I don't know if I trust my spot and stock skills, with my bow. But two, I like that it's in September because it kind of spreads my hunts out. You know, I'm doing the South Texas hunt, in December, or I think it's late November, early December. And so, yeah, you know, I don't live close to Kansas. Like, I'm not just going to run up there for a Saturday and come back home. And so if I go, it's going to be like a dedicated trip. And so, part of the reason I want to do the early muzzleloaders because that's, you know, mid-September, and then I kind of get a nice long break for work and family and everything, and then I'll go to South Texas at the end of November. That's kind of what I'm thinking. I don't know where I was going with that. So that's the plan. That's the Kansas plan. I was just kind of laying out my seasons. So yeah, do that hunt in September instead of Nebraska, I think. October, I'll be hunting Oklahoma mostly. November, go to my buddy's place in Texas, finish up in Oklahoma if I need to, and then at the end of the month, head down to South Texas to do the mule deer hunt. So that's what it's looking like for this year. I'm sure I'll talk about that more later, but that's enough of me rambling. Let's go ahead and get into this week's episode. Like I mentioned, we have a really, really good one. Tyrell is just a wealth of knowledge, and he's one of those guys, like, if you had to put some money on somebody, you know, killing a big buck in Oklahoma, Tyrell's the guy. He loves hunting himself. He, you know, gets friends and family on deer all the time. Just a really, really good guy and a really good whitetail hunter. And so, you know, we'll get into it in the episode, but basically he wanted to push himself a little bit. And so he drew a Kansas tag. He willingly chose to hunt public land instead of, you know, he had some access to private, but he wanted to hunt on public basically just to prove it to himself that he could do it. And just like I talk about all the time, like I've loved doing more of this out-of-state stuff because it really, it makes you grow as a hunter and it really makes you learn and focus on the craft. And that is what he wanted to do. And so he went there, had a great time, had a great season, lots of cool story, learned a ton. And it's something that is very educational for all of us listening. So yeah, that's what we got going this week. I'll go ahead and be quiet now. We got a really good one with Tyrell Roy, and we will get into that episode right now. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's show. And today we got our old buddy Tyrell Roy. How you doing, Tyrell?
Doing good. How about yourself?
Man, I'm doing great. I always look forward to having you on. I lost count. This is your third or fourth time, I think, on the show. And it's just always good to catch up with you. So really looking forward to this. Before we get going into all the awesome stuff, Tyrell, why don't you just introduce yourself real quick?
Yeah, so my name's Tyrell Roy. I grew up in central Oklahoma and moved up to northern Oklahoma or northwest Oklahoma 8 or 9 years ago. And I farm up here for a living. Got two little girls and a wife and hunt as much as I can in my spare time.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And man, one, you're just an awesome person, but two, part of the reason I love having you on is it seems like every year you yourself are either extremely successful or you know, have friends and family out there and you help them be successful. And so you just, it seems like every year gain so much knowledge and everything because you're just out there and you get to do it so much. So like I said, really appreciate you coming on this week. And man, yeah, I'm ready to get into it. So, I'm trying to decide if I want to let you give a brief little overview of your season real quick, or if we just want to jump into Kansas. I tell you what, real quick, just so everybody kind of knows what we're dealing with, why don't you give us the quick little 3 to 5 minute version of how your season went this last year?
Okay. So yeah, that's tough. So well, yeah, I had a great year this year. Mm-hmm. One of the best years I've ever had. It, as well as my some family, friends that hunt with me. We just had an exceptional year. Some, I would say, quality deer management paying off in a big way for us. And, yeah, so early, like within the first week of October, I shot a 6-year-old buck that we had a few years earlier on the farm. He disappeared for a year or two and then showed back up. And so I was able to shoot him. And then in November, so I think November 2nd, I shot a buck. I'd been just crossing my fingers that he would live and letting him go for a few years to that he would get to that 5-year-old mark. And then I would, you know, want to pursue him where he would be expressing his, you know, what I felt like was his potential. So I was able to go after that deer and connect with that deer as well. Plus, made it to Kansas, drew a Kansas tag this year, and spent a lot of time in Kansas, and was finally successful in Kansas in December.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a fantastic year. If I'm being honest, I was a little jealous because that's kind of the year I was hoping for last year. I'd been lining everything up with my Iowa hunt, and yeah, I got it done in Oklahoma, which is always great. But I ate tag soup in Iowa as well as tag soup in Texas. Actually, I think I only made it to Texas for one day. And so that one, a little easier to justify. But yeah, man, awesome, awesome season. And I'd love to touch on, you know, your Oklahoma stuff if we have time. But just I think I'd really like to focus this week on your Kansas hunt. Just something a little different, you know, out of the ordinary for everybody. And I think one thing that I've discovered the last couple of years, doing a little bit more out-of-state hunting. You know, I've been going to Nebraska because my sister moved up there and stuff, and I have learned so much more just about whitetails and hunting whitetails and their behavior from doing these out-of-state hunts, because it kind of puts you out of your element. You don't have that historical data and everything. And so talking to somebody who is as experienced as yourself, I'd love to hear about kind of putting you out of your element a little bit. And so that's what I want to focus on today. So let's start kind of from the beginning. Talk just for a brief moment, if you don't mind, just kind of about the Kansas tag situation, because it's not as simple as just going to Walmart and buying a tag. So if you wouldn't mind covering just a little bit kind of the draw system and how all that all works.
Yeah, so, yeah, it's definitely not as easy as just going and buy a tag. Like Oklahoma, it's just, you know, so easy. Out of state, come to Oklahoma, buy an over-the-counter tag, get two buck tags, and it's really easy for out-of-staters here in the state of Oklahoma. But Kansas was way different. And the first year, so I put in the year prior, and, you know, all my buddies told me I was going to get the tag, and I didn't draw it. Mm-hmm. So I was, you know, a little bit on my heels. I was planning on going to Kansas, and that's what I was going to do. Didn't draw a tag, but I got a point, and then reapplied. So, you know, Kansas is you apply for a unit, and then you select an additional unit, has to be adjoining to your unit that you can also hunt in. So, that, you know, that's what I did. I live 30 miles from the Kansas border, so I chose a unit that was close to me, and then an additional unit that I could hunt.
Yeah.
So last year, 2023, I drew that tag. I can't remember when the draw results come out in the summer. Yeah. So I was fired up. You know, I got the email that I drew that tag, and I was fired up. I've been wanting to do that hunt for a long time, and so my father-in-law or my wife's family, they own a pretty good sized farm in Kansas in that unit the unit I was drawing. But my I really wanted to go up there and do the public thing and do something different, because I have really access to really good land here in where I live in the county that I live in. And so I wanted to do something that was different, like you were saying earlier, put you out of your comfort zone. And force me to learn and put what I know into practice.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my whole goal going into that Kansas hunt.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this real quick before we go any further, because this is something I had to deal with last year, like when I drew that Iowa tag, and maybe this, I don't know, maybe, I guess my question is, like, how did your out-of-state trip go as far as your priorities? Because like you said, you know, we're both pretty fortunate to have some pretty awesome places to hunt here in Oklahoma. I know you were you had a big deer that you're chasing here, but there's also that kind of that excitement level. And like, you know, for me going to Iowa, like even if I didn't shoot a deer as big as a deer I could kill here, which there was obviously that chance, it was still just something new and exciting and different. And so for me, it was always hard of like, you know, do I want to be up there at the peak of the rut? Do I want to be at my own place during the peak of the rut? How did that kind of go for you?
Yeah. So yeah, the priority thing is a big thing, because there's so many different pulls, you know, on our time, you know, family, work, and then obviously the desire to hunt the peak times on your own place where you know the land, you know how the deer use it, you know the deer that are there. And the unknown of going somewhere can be daunting.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, so you have all these pulls on your time or priorities or whatever. And, you know, like you were saying, you're excited or whatever to go to Iowa and hunt a place that potentially you've never set foot on. You walk into a place, you're pitting yourself against a whitetail. And that's, you know, that's what if we're serious deer hunters, that's what we try to do. And as individuals, we we have a need for adventure. And that adventure can come, you know, from different aspects, whether it's a career or just different things that we, in my adventure is getting out and seeing new places and experiencing new things. And I'm so thankful that I have a wife that supports me in that. And, you know, family that backs me, a job that I can do that. So as the season drew nearer in the summer, I had time. I would spend a day, and I would take, sometimes I would take my daughter or both my daughters up to Kansas, and we would go in glass. And I was just trying to, I wasn't necessarily walking into public pieces or walk-in pieces. I was just driving the perimeter, glassing, trying to build a plan, a game plan. So as the season drew near, I ended up finding a really nice buck on a public piece, not a walk-in. It was a big chunk of public. So because of the size of that deer and, you know, the accessibility to that deer, like he was very patternable, very, in my mind, very killable. My priority level to Kansas was pretty high, especially because their season opens several weeks earlier than our season. So my whole mindset was the first couple weeks of season, which was the last couple weeks of September, I could get up there, hopefully kill a deer, and then I'd have all season here to hunt.
Mm-hmm.
That was my mindset. So early on, my priority was pretty high to Kansas. Like it's, you know, it's with anywhere from 30-minute drive to, you know, 2 hours to the areas that I was hunting. I mean, it's not that far. So I could leave early in the morning and hunt all day Saturday. I could be back Sunday or Saturday night and, you know, fulfill the family duties that I needed to fulfill. So that was my priority. And then as the season progressed, as we got into late October and November, then my priority switched a little bit to the deer that I had here, because I had a really big deer here that I'd had for several years. He quit showing up in the late summer, and he was just gone until October 30th. So when he showed back up, then my priority switched. Then I was on him until I killed him. Then it was back to Kansas.
Nice. Yeah, it's one super awesome that you were that close. That definitely makes things way easier. Yeah, that's nice. And I also got to applaud you that I think it's really cool that even though you had the opportunity to go to that private land, that you still went to the public, just like we were saying, for the adventure and to push yourself. So I think that's really cool too. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, isn't Kansas one of the states that banned trail cameras on public land last year, year or two?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, last year they banned it. So this was the first year that was enacted.
Gotcha.
And, you know, I use trail cameras. I know how to use trail cameras. I use trail cameras a lot on travel corridors, scrapes, or, you know, whatever. And that would have been my plan of attack. I would have put several trail cameras out and at least checked them to see, get information. But that just wasn't available to me, which was – it was fine. Honestly, it was fine with me because – it just forced me that much more to use my knowledge, you know, to use what I know and you get in there and just try things. And that's how I learned how to bow hunt. I didn't have a lot of people that were bow hunters that could teach me things about bow hunting and, you know, everything that's involved that now I don't even think about. And so now I could go into a place and just through trial and error figure it out, and that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was talking about at the beginning. Just it sounds kind of weird to say, but it you feel like you're hunting. You know, you're not sitting over a feeder or a food plot that you worked on. Like, you're having to go in there and figure things out. And that's almost sad to say. And I myself have a little bit of a hesitation to say, well, you know, what I do normally isn't necessarily, like, it's still hunting, but it's just different.
Yeah. So I'd say like where I live in the, I have two permission farms that I have worked really hard to get permission on. And I do my best to maintain that relationship with those landowners and keep that permission farm, those permission farms. And they are some of the best land that I could ever dream up of hunting. And so I have the ability to be very selective in what I shoot and what I hunt. So I want to target one specific deer. So that's the challenge for me. If I was going into my farm trying to shoot a mature deer, that's pretty doable. But when I target a specific deer, that's the challenge. So now I have to figure out a specific deer, put myself in a position to kill that deer. That's the challenge. That's the reward. When I go to Kansas or anywhere where I'm hunting public, the goal is completely changed. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, I'm fine with that. There's guys in maybe the Southeast or the, you know, the Northeast that are, or anywhere in the East, that are way better hunters than I am, that shoot 120, 100-inch deer every year on public land. They're way better hunters than I am. Mm-hmm. I don't need to shoot 180-inch deer to prove to anybody how good of a hunter I am, because there's guys doing it every single year on the hardest places in the United States to hunt. Those are, to, in my opinion, those are the guys that are the real killers. Mm-hmm. And so when I want to go to Kansas, I want to hunt the public land. I want to hunt the pressured places, and I want to see if I can even come close, you know, to getting it done. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you, it was way harder than I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. So before we get into the hunt itself, I want to talk about kind of the landscape real quick. And I know you're kind of a northwestern Oklahoma guy, so you're maybe used to a little bit more sparse landscape than, say, I am further east, but describe the terrain you were dealing with. Was it pretty much wide open? Were there still some timber pockets? Where were you chasing this deer at?
Okay, so the deer that I had spotted early season that I really wanted to kill and that I was like, this is the deer I'm hunting, and I, because of that, I didn't have any backup plan. That deer was in a place that was just rolling sand hills and like really short scrubby brush, and then a few tree rows or windbreaks or whatever you want to call them, and a couple, like, you know, 4 or 5 acre pockets of timber. And when I say timber, I mean like 15 to 20 foot tall trees, not very tall. Mm-hmm. And just kind of like locust, and not trees that you could get a tree stand in. Mm-hmm. And that, so that was the terrain that that deer that I found was living in. And there was, on the private property close to there, there were several pivots that had corn and soybeans on them. And he was traveling from the public going about half a mile to that, those pivots to feed every evening. So that was the terrain that I was going to be hunting that deer in. Now, some of the other places that I ended up hunting a lot were more heavily like river bottom type of stuff with, you know, big cottonwood trees and cedar thickets and some walnut groves and stuff like that, where it was a lot more trees, even more so than what I'm used to hunting here in northern Oklahoma where I live, northwest Oklahoma where I live.
Gotcha. All right. So let's, I'll let you keep going. Let's get into the hunt itself then. You broke a little news there that it sounds like you lost track of maybe that first buck you saw.
Yeah, well, actually, so the day before, so season up there opened on Monday, mm-hmm. Monday morning, and I couldn't hunt Monday, but I was up there Saturday and Sunday, and I watched this buck both evenings do the exact same thing that he'd been doing for the last like 4 weeks. He was leaving this like 5 acre, or it was bigger than that. It was probably like 10 acre or so, a patch of trees, and he was traveling to this cornfield that was a half mile away as a pivot. So Sunday, I sat on that deer until he went out into that field. The season opened Monday. I couldn't hunt Monday. I wasn't going to be able to make it back up there till the following weekend. And it was 2 miles into that place. So I walked out at dark, got to my truck, and I'm down a dead end road. as I'm driving out, I see headlights coming down the road. And I'm thinking, man, this probably isn't a good sign, because I knew the season opened the next day. And Kansas, the opening day is also the opening day of muzzleloader season. For, I don't know how long it was, 9 days or something, a week, I can't remember. But I thought, I see headlights. I pull up to the vehicle, and, you know, I'm going to stop and talk just to see what this guy knows. Well, it was a hunting celebrity, quote unquote. This was a guy that everyone knows, that is in the industry. Mm-hmm. And so he was super, super nice. Talked to him. He didn't know the deer was there. I didn't tell him the deer was there, but I could tell he didn't know the deer was there.
Yeah.
So we exchanged information. The next day, he sends me a message, a picture of the deer. They had shot, him and his buddy shot that deer. The opening day.
Yeah.
So that, like, chopped out any plan I had, because everything that I had was focused on that place. And so then I'm back to the drawing board, but it's, the season is open. So that next weekend, I went back up there, and I went further east to a pretty good sized chunk of public. And it's pretty diverse, but there's a river and a lake on it. And it's got lots of timber, and they plant food plots in there. And I ended up spending quite a bit of time there. I spent that weekend there. I went back there several times hunting that place, because it was big enough that I thought I could get away from pressure. There was enough timber on it that I knew it had to hold deer, but the deer numbers on that place were just way lower than the other piece that I had previously been hunting. So that really, I would find sign in there, but the problem with being so close to where I was hunting, which was an hour and 20 minutes from where I live, is I could go up there for a day, and then I would come home. And then a week later or 2 weeks later, I would go back up there. And everything that I had learned that day or 2 days I was there was now invalid, because that time frame from September 15th or whenever that season opened to mid-October, everything is changing. So everything I learned, I couldn't apply the next time I went back up there. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. You got crops changing, you got deer shifting patterns and everything. So yeah, that's a very pivotal time for
stuff to change. That I feel like actually hurt me being so close. Now if I had gone up there for five whole days and was able to put something together, and then, you know, I feel like I might have had a better chance in that early time of the hunt. But that's just that's not how it played out. And I also, you know, talking to anybody that is interested in going up there and trying that, which I highly recommend it. But I finally later did this, and this is what I would recommend doing at the very beginning. If you have a unit or two units that you're hunting, spend 2 days and go to every single piece of public on within those units and just look at them. I had e-scouted a ton, and I looked at these places on the map. Like, these places look really good. These places don't. And then when I would go to them, the places that looked really good were, like, overgrazed. There wasn't a blade of grass on it, or, you know, it's just some weird thing, or there was bulldozers in there clearing a fence line or something. And then so it ended up being some of the places that I had overlooked that I actually went to look at. And I was like, oh, wow, this is a lot better than it looked like on the map. And turns out, you know, ultimately that was the place where I found the most deer. You know, so we go, you know, so we start. I start in September. I hunt the last couple of weeks of September. We're pretty busy on the farm the last couple of weeks of September, the first half of October. Pretty busy. So I didn't have a chance to go up there till, you know, mid to late October, and made several trips up there on some cold fronts, and just was, I mean, I was not seeing any deer on the public land. I was only seeing a few does and 1-year-old bucks. That's all I was seeing. What to me was amazing too is I would find bay sites and cameras everywhere on the public land.
Yeah.
Everywhere. And I thought, like, okay, not like one, but man, I found so many. And they would be like right off the road. There'd be a camera. There'd be a pile of corn or, you know, whatever, Big and Jay or whatever. Mm-hmm. Man, it blew my mind how many people were baiting on that public land.
Yeah.
And running cameras with the, even with a camera band. They don't care, I guess.
I guess they're thinking, who's going to catch me?
Yeah, I mean, if somebody stumbles in there and sees a bait pile, how are they going to catch anybody? Yeah. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know how that works. Yeah. Unless you just set up your own surveillance or sit there and watch, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I was going in and I was seeing lots of sign. I would see find some big scrapes. But I did not see one mature deer on any of that stuff I was hunting. And so it was starting to get discouraging, you know. And then in Oklahoma, I had a buck show up in late October. And I guess I spent a week hunting that deer before I killed him. And then my wife hunted, you know, she hunted all the rut. And so I was, you know, trying to get her on a deer here in Oklahoma. So I didn't end up making it back to Kansas till late November, like after the rut. Mm-hmm. And when I went back there, I kind of had a different mindset. My mindset, you know, was I've got to find food, number one. It's getting into late season. And I've got to find where the deer are. And I can't think like I have to go up there and hunt. I got to think like I got to go up there and find the deer. Mm. So I went up there for, I think it was like, it was one full day. It was a half a day on either side. And I just drove to every single piece of public land within my units. And some of them I would drive up to. I would think, okay, this is worth looking at. I would walk into it, maybe look at a little piece of timber or a shelter belt or something. And, you know, check it off or say this is, has potential. And I did that all day, like half a day, and pretty much all day the next day. And then I ended up hunting a piece that was, there was very few trees on it, but it bordered some ag, the private land bordering it with some ag. And I ended up seeing a lot of deer on these little pieces that had ag bordered in it, but these pieces were, they would be very few trees, lots of native grass, and these deer were just holding in that native grass and it bedding in it and mm-hmm. going out to the ag field in the evening. So that's what I started keying in on. And I ended up finding this pretty good sized piece of weehaw. And it had some like plum thickets on it and some big lot of native grass, and it had this one little pocket of trees. And when I say little, I mean really little. So I ended up setting up in it and walking into it. You know, it's always wild. Just like, I'm going to walk into a place for the first time and I'm going to climb up in a tree and hunt to the way I hunt here. It's that's so foreign. Like, I would never just randomly climb into a tree. I go into a tree to kill a deer, mm-hmm. but there it's like, okay, I got to go get in a tree. I got to if there's any deer, I got to walk in, find the sign, you know, whatnot. So I start walking into this place and I found a really good trail. And, you know, when I would drive these places, I would drive the whole perimeter that I could, that was road, and look and see if anybody had pulled off the road or if I could see anybody where somebody was hunting or whatever. And a lot of these pieces I would find there, it didn't look like there'd been anybody into them. So and it was late season. I mean, people weren't going to be, I feel like the out-of-staters go like that pre-rut. Mm-hmm. But after that, there's probably not a lot of out-of-staters that go hunt this public. And the local people probably have their own private, I'm guessing. But
yeah.
So I went into this little piece and climbed up in a tree, hunted that evening. And I saw 12 deer. And I saw 2 3-year-old bucks. So I was pumped. That's the most I'd seen the whole time on the land that I could hunt. So I was like, there's got to be a bigger buck in here. So as I left that place, right at dark, I kind of made a little loop, a little bit long way to the truck, and there was a scrape, a giant scrape, and it had just been worked. I mean, it was pee in it. It had just been pulled up. I mean, it was freshly worked. And it was just out of my sight from where I'd been set up. So that gave me so much confidence in the place. I'm like, I'm in the right place. I just got to maybe adjust my setup. So the next morning, I went back there and hunted, and I saw a three-year-old 10-point that he came by me. I mean, it was, everything was perfect, but I just couldn't bring myself to shoot him because, for whatever reason, I don't know, because it just really wasn't what I went to Kansas for. Yeah. I went to Kansas for an experience, for a mature deer, four-year-old deer. But
man, that's a mental battle I have with myself every time I go out of state, because like I said at the beginning, you know, we're both pretty blessed with where we get to hunt here in Oklahoma. And so it's like, where does that standard apply when you go out of state and you're hunting a piece of public where you've never stepped foot before and you may never step again? You know, I deal with that when I go to Nebraska. I was dealing with it in Iowa. It's hard. It really is. I mean, I know exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely difficult. You know, in my head, I'm thinking, man, I just need to shoot a deer. I need to get this monkey off my back. And that deer came walking down. He worked that scrape, and I couldn't do it. And it wasn't even like a question. I saw a deer. I looked at him. I'm like, nope, I'm not going to shoot that deer. So then I go home for a week. I come back the next Saturday, and I go right back to that place, and everything was dead. But I could see from where I was, because I could see, you know, up there, it's just wide open. I could see forever. And as I was glassing, as it got dark, I could see what the deer were doing. They're staying in this little thicket on the private, and they were going to this cut bean field that was also private. And they were missing where I, you know, the piece that I could hunt by 100 yards. And that's what they did that evening. That next morning, I went back there. They did the same thing, coming off and going to bed on the private, just right off the public, which told me that like the likelihood of them at this point in the season coming to where I could hunt them or call to them or anything was slim to none. So I, in my mind, I just checked that piece off. I hunted another walk-in piece and didn't see anything that evening. And now this is December, I think 11th, which was Saturday or 10th or something like that. So I head back home. I guess this was Sunday. So I hunt Sunday morning, Sunday evening to hunt, and I head back home Sunday night. Now that night that I stayed up there in my pickup, it got so cold, and I don't know if I got sick or something. I got this horrible cough. So I go back home Sunday, and no, I'm saying this wrong. I went up there Sunday afternoon, stayed all day Monday, came home Monday night. That's what I did.
Gotcha.
Came home Monday night, and Tuesday we had cows out because a tree had fallen on the fence. So I was out there chainsawing a tree off the fence, and I get a phone call from a guy that I know up there in Kansas, and he has a lease, big lease up there. And he called me and said, hey, I'm driving to my lease to go hunt, and I saw a buck on this piece of public. And it was a piece that I'd hunted several times. It was a lot closer to where I live, further, you know, south in Kansas, a lot closer to where I live. So I'd hunted it several times just because, you know, if I didn't have much time, I could go up there in the evening and hunt it. Whatever. So he calls me and says, there's this deer. I saw it was not too far off the road, and whatever. So I'm thinking in my head, there's the chance of me going up there and finding that deer is just like next to none. So I just keep working. At lunchtime, I'm telling my wife, and she's like, go up there, see if you can find it.
Great wife.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So I'm like, okay, maybe I'll, maybe I, so I called her. I was still at work. I called her to ask what the lunch plan was, and I had told her, like, about this situation, and she said, just go for it. Well, I had my bow in my pickup and some of my pack and some of my gear, and I was like, you know, what the heck, I might as well. So I drive up there. It is, you know, it's like 40 minutes. Drive up there to this piece. I drive to where the guy had sent me the pin of the deer, and I don't see anything. And so this piece is like kind of runs long ways east to west. And I'm on the north side of it driving west, and I'm looking, you know, south into this piece of public. And it's pretty much all, you know, native grass, just tall native grass. But 200, 300 yards off the road, this flat that's native grass goes into this ridge of sand hills. And on that sand hill, because of the sand, the grass is way shorter. And where he had sent me the pin, the deer was kind of on the side of that sand hill. So I go on, I creep along there, and I would glass and look. I couldn't find anything. I end up parking at the west end, and the wind was from the east, like kind of southeast. So I walk down the west property line, and I, you know, the 200 or 300 yards or whatever it was to that ridge of sand hills. And then I start easing to the east along those sand hills, thinking I might, you know, I might get lucky and see embedded or whatever. So I just go really, and it's pretty windy. So I just go really slow, easing along there, glassing, looking, and I get to that point where the pin was, where that guy had seen the deer. So the guy had called me at like 11 o'clock. So it's an odd time to see a deer, mm-hmm. right, in the day, especially in mid-December. So in my mind, I'm thinking maybe that deer is changing his bed because the wind had shifted that morning. So I think that's what I'm thinking. Maybe he was shifting his bed when he had seen that deer. So then as I get to that spot, I'm thinking where would he move his bed to? And every once in a while, I would go to the top of the sand hills, and I would look to the south and just see if I could see anything. And it was a lot of, you know, native grass in there as well, but it wasn't as thick and tall. Well, as I got to that pin, I sat there for a while looking around, trying to think what he would do, looking at Onyx. And I decided to crawl to the top of the hill and look over. When I got to the top of the sand hill, 40 yards away is a plum thicket that's, yeah, I don't know if it's 10 by 10 yards by 20 yards, plum thicket. In my mind, I'm thinking, perfect. Like, I could see him just moving over to this hill. And it was on the side hill, so he could look to the west, which would have been his downwind, which makes sense to me. It made sense. He could smell anything coming from the east. He could look to his downwind to the west if he was in that, theoretically, if he's in that plum thicket. And then I also thought, straight to the west of me is standing beans. And I knew, I'd watched lots of deer go to those standing beans. So it made sense that if he wasn't bedded close to me, he would move that direction anyway. And if I'm on the sand hill, I could see him, maybe I could cut him off. Keep in mind, I also don't know what the buck is either.
Yeah,
I just know it's a buck.
Yeah.
So I crawl up onto the top of that sand hill, and, you know, it's full of sand burrs. So I like pull them all, you know, trying to make me a spot in the sand where I can get out of the sand burrs. And I sat there for over two hours. And, you know, nothing happened. And I'm beginning to play that game, that mental game in my head, like, what am I doing here? I should be at home, or I should be at work, or whatever, you know, all the things. There's no way I'm going to get a shot at this deer or even probably see this deer. And the sun starts going down, and it's like 30 minutes before dark. And Carly, my wife, texts me and says, like, how's it going? Are you seeing anything? And I feel my phone vibrate. I pick it out of my pocket. I look at the text, and I'm like texting. But the whole, you know, when you're in that situation the whole time, you're like scanning, you know, you're looking. And before, when I got there, like for the last 3 hours or whatever, I had scanned that plum thicket with my binoculars just looking for a piece of a deer. And I'd never seen anything. Plus, I start texting her back. I'm like, one letter, look, one letter, look. And I look up and I see antlers in that thicket. And I don't know if he hadn't stood up yet, but he had just moved his antlers to where I could see tines and antlers. So I just said, I just finished texting Carly and said, I'm within bow range and or something like that. And then put my phone up and I grabbed my bow. I had ranged the edge of the thicket. It was like 45 yards. And so I just clip on and wait. And he had moved his head a little bit and then he just stood up. Perfectly broad. Well, he ended up being a little bit according to me. It looked like he was perfectly broadside. And he, you know how they stretch, just a huge stretch. So as soon as I saw him making that standing motion, like I drew back and, well, I guess I changed my sight, but I drew back and he started to stretch and I just anchored and released. And 45 yards is, it's enough time to watch that arrow and think, what funny. And that, I mean, it was one of the most beautiful things you've ever seen. That arrow arcing and just smoking him. It looked perfect. Like right behind the shoulder, just buried through him. I mean, like disappeared in him. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's a dead deer. And he takes off running and he runs like 250 yards. And, you know, I expected at any moment to fall over, like a double lung deer falls over really fast. And he just kept running and running and running. I'm like, oh, my God, what happened? So he stops way out there on the sandhill and just stands there, you know, like acting like a gunshot deer. Just head down, stand there. Then he would lay down, but then he would stand back up, turn around. Long story short, it gets dark on me, and I kind of went a little closer to him, but I couldn't get close enough for a follow-up shot. And he was just, when it got too dark to see, he was just laying down on the side of that sandhill. So I waited a while and went back in there. I don't know how long I waited, probably 2 hours. Went back in there and he was dead. What ended up happening, he was quartered to me a little bit. It went in perfect, but it only got one lung and liver.
Yeah.
And it just took him a little bit longer to expire.
Yeah, those one lung deer can take some stuff and keep on going. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah.
Yeah. Man, that is that's an awesome story. Like I feel like that's the adventure, like that is the hunt that you dream about when you think about going up there and hunting public land. That's awesome.
I know, yeah. It was like when I had left Monday evening to come home, I was pretty much in the mindset like I'm not gonna fill this tag. Mm-hmm. And then just, you know, one phone call and actually pursuing something and being patient paid off.
Yeah.
In a big way.
Yeah.
I mean, I am so proud of that deer. Like, I don't know. I've killed bigger deer, but that deer I'm very proud of.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, that's awesome. I got a few observations, then a couple questions. And the first big one was just like, you know, we talked about kind of a reason for doing these types of hunts and getting out of your comfort zone. Like how you talked about, you know, the wind shifting and having to process like, okay, the deer was here. Where would he go if the wind shifted? There's food over there. How does that relate to where he was? Like just putting all those pieces together like that. That's the whole reason I was talking about why people should do stuff like this. Cause it puts you out of your element. It makes you have to figure that stuff out. Because you don't just know from years of observation that deer normally go from this spot and they go this way. Like putting all those pieces together is why you need to get out of your comfort zone. And that's just a great example of it. So, that was one thing. And then another thing you mentioned that you kind of figured out, and I've had a guy named Josh Garut on the podcast several times, and he was the one that kind of pounded this into my head. He hunts Kansas a lot and kind of western Iowa, you know, kind of the more plains areas. And he's like, you know, you hear people talk about boots on the ground all the time. And so many people in most areas where whitetail live, you're always hearing boots on the ground. But he's like, and sometimes in situations like that, we're in those open places, it's more about dirt on the tires and spending time in the truck and behind the glass and just looking, because you can cover so much more ground. And, you know, I know I've spent enough time in Kansas to know it's a lot like a lot of places in Oklahoma where there's a road every mile by mile, and you can kind of cut that country apart and you can find high areas and do some glassing. So, yeah, that was just kind of another observation I made. And then one big question I have, and kind of spoiler alert for the people listening, but I plan to hunt Kansas this year. I know I always talk about it, but I'm pretty sure I'm actually going to do it this year. So I've been doing some scouting, like you mentioned. And I find myself just automatically being drawn to those little bitty patches of cover, like you talk, you know, the little timber, or, you know, one that sticks out in my head. I was scouting a piece of walk-in, and there was like an old homestead, and you could see where they had their windbreak. There's like three perfect little rows of cedars. But then you also talked about, you know, a lot about like how the deer would bed in the native grass and really use that a lot. Would you say you... maybe out of habit or just from what you learned, like, did you focus on those patches of cover a lot, or did you get to a point to where, like, man, these deer, like, if there's tall grass, they could be anywhere?
I got to that point where if there's tall grass, they could be anywhere. And I've always heard that about Kansas, but once you have, I mean, you kind of have to go up there and experience that firsthand for that to sink in. And I think that is even more true on the public land pieces because of pressure or whatever.
The people like me. People like me, they're like, oh, there's trees. They got to be deer there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's exactly what I ran into. I would see, you know, a chunk of timber, and there would be multiple pickups there, and they would all be out-of-state pickups, and they are doing the exact same thing I was. They're looking at Onyx. They're saying, look, here's a good piece of CRP next to trees. And by default, they hunt the trees. Number one, that's where they can get their tree stand.
Yeah.
So they go in there, they hunt the trees. It makes sense to their to our minds, you know. That's what makes sense. But to those deer, I mean, they figure that out. Now, I will say, Matt, and I almost feel like in certain parts of Kansas, this is almost a cheat code. Deer, especially bucks, bed in the CRP. But if there is trees, they check the trees out. Now, if there's big timber where there's, you know, multiple people hunting, maybe not. But if there's places where there's little timber, like you said, there's cedar windbreaks, those spots, they check out. I don't know how many times I was sitting somewhere, and it might have been on the side of the road in my pickup, and I would see a deer come out of grass and go to a little piece of timber. They always loop downwind of it. They would go and check it. There was probably a scrape, or they would make a rub, and then they would leave it. They weren't there very long, but they always checked it out. And I saw this happen multiple times. And I've also experienced this in Oklahoma too, where there's big pieces, some places I have to hunt that are really big open places with little trees here and there. They just go check that. They're just drawn to it, just kind of like we are. But if a deer is pressured, they'll adapt to it.
Yeah.
And if there's a little, you know, a little group of trees where, you know, there's not hunters hiding in because they're not big enough to hide in, they're drawn to that.
Gotcha. That leads me perfectly into my last question here is, you know, I was planning to ask you, like, if you hunted on the ground a lot more, just one, just because there aren't trees, or two, if you just found yourself not necessarily needing to be in a tree. And you mentioned it with, like, a lot of the out-of-state hunters and, you know, just kind of flocking those areas. But, and obviously you shot this buck off the ground, but did you find yourself hunting off the ground way more than you expected?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I learned here with my experience here in Oklahoma, like, to kill deer, you just have to be where they are or in the path, in their bedroom, whatever, that they're used. And it doesn't. It doesn't need to be the perfect tree or setup. That's, you know, the secondary thing. So that translated really well to Kansas, because the trees that were there had hunters in them. So by default, it made sense to me to go where there wasn't trees. So I would set up on a sandhill in glass, or I would tuck into a fence row or a thicket. And I feel like you can be very successful doing that. it's definitely different, and it's a when you've done something for so long, it's hard to just change that. But I feel like to be successful in that part of Kansas, you have to have a very open mind to your approach.
Yeah. Did you, you know, I'm just picturing like a giant, you know, 160-acre track or whatever of CRP. Were you concerned about like basically being able to shoot because the grass is so tall, or maybe late season it's laid down a little bit? But I know that's one thing that I always struggle with when I'm hunting more open terrain is just like getting a shot. So how did you manage that?
Well, the first thing I did was I shot a ton, you know, in the off season leading up and during the season out to, you know, 80, 90 yards, just trying to be comfortable. Not that I would shoot at deer that far, but I was the most comfortable, most confident I've ever been in my shooting this, you know, going into the fall of this year, because I just shot and shot and shot and shot. So I feel like that is something that's the, where you have to start. You have to be 100% confident in your, and be able to shoot to 50 yards, you know, 50 yards, 60 yards. I mean, I don't know if you would shoot that far, but be able to consistently do it. So then when you are faced, I was faced with a 45 yard shot, which is the furthest I've ever shot a buck. And, you know, to be able to pull that shot off without thinking about it is, you know, I feel like that's key. The other thing though is, There was places where I would hunt in the CRP where all you could see is pines. You couldn't see does walking through it. You could see, and to me, I just like, okay, there's a chunk of CRP that's so tall I can't set up in and get a shot. But there's an entry and there's an exit, and that's the spot that I would hunt. And that exit is going to be a fence. It's going to be, you know, a creek or a tree row, or, you know, some kind of terrain change, an edge, like we hunt anyway. We all, you know, whitetail hunters, we hunt edges. So finding where that edge was, and sometimes the edge was harder to find than we're here where I hunt, where it might be just a super soft transition between a type of grass where you had really tall blue stem or something, and it transitioned to a like goldenrod or something. So then I could actually set up in that area and shoot over it.
Yeah. Ah, man, sounds awesome. Makes me want to go for sure. So, man, I'm trying to think if I have anything else for you. I think you punched my ticket as far as questions I had and anything. Any just general, you know, from being up there and doing it, somebody's looking at doing it for the first time, any just general tips or tactics you have for them?
You know, I'd say something that probably a lot of people don't think about. I definitely didn't think about it until I was confronted with it, is there's a lot of people in Kansas residents who don't want out-of-staters in their state hunting. And I try to be very respectful and incognito when I go up there. I don't want to be, you know, rubbing it in their face that I'm up there hunting. And I got cussed out for being on the side of the road glassing into a public piece because I have Oklahoma plates.
Yeah,
I mean, that's something that you should think about going up there. Like, be in the mindset, like, it could happen, you know. Don't, and at least my mindset is, don't be a jerk. Respect the resource, and that these guys, there might be guys up there that only have public to hunt, and Kansas is literally flooded with people because it's a dream. Everybody wants to go to Kansas and hunt.
Yeah.
But I also would say this. There's people up there that hunt that don't like people from out of state coming to their state and hunting their public land. But the landowners up there are some of the nicest people you can meet, and I would not hesitate to knock on doors and ask for permission. They are – I think some of the guys I talked to up there are the most receptive to that idea of anywhere I've ever been. So I would keep that in the back of your mind. Like, if you see a buck, go find some address or something and go knock on the door. They're some of the nicest people you will meet.
Yeah. That's awesome. I did think of one last question, And I did not prep you for this, so feel free to answer at your leisure, because I am curious. I've started asking this to a few people that I have on. And I ask you this because I feel like you may fall in line a little bit more with me and less with the general public. There's a lot of talk of making Oklahoma a one-buck state. And a lot of people look at, you know, Kansas to the north and a lot of other states, and they're saying we could be that if we, you know, limited non-residents and went to a one buck. But again, you know, you and I are in a similar situation. I love having that second buck tag. A lot of times I'm using it for more of a management tag. But I do get the point of, you know, so an out-of-stater can come and shoot two yearlings or whatever. So I'm curious just to hear your thoughts on the one buck tag.
Yeah, I'm against it for sure.
Yeah.
I think Oklahoma's doing a pretty good job of managing their deer herds. Mm-hmm. We have a problem, and it's not that too many bucks are getting killed. Oklahoma's producing some giant deer every single year. Multiple giant deer. And when I'm talking giant, I'm talking mega giant deer. Plus, you know, the 200-inch deer, plus the 180s and 190s. I mean, we're definitely a sleeper state, for sure. I would not push two bucks. There's very, very few out-of-staters coming here and shooting multiple bucks.
Yeah.
And if they are, they're more than likely shooting one borderline mature buck and maybe one younger buck. Or maybe I have a buddy that comes here every year, and he has shot – there's been years he's come down here and shot 2 5-year-old deer. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, I have no problem with that.
Yeah.
Now, if they want to limit the out-of-state, okay, but don't limit my ability to shoot two bucks, because like you said, it is a tool that we have to manage our deer population. And I have multiple 6, 7, 8-year-old deer on my farms that are 130 inches that I don't want to shoot that will run my prospects off every single year. These I call these bucks bully bucks. They will come in and they will run off 3-year-olds that are 170 inches, 4-year-olds that are 170 inches, and run them onto the neighbors, and the neighbors shoot them. So I want to have a tool in my toolbox to manage my deer population. Now, the department gives us every resource to manage our doe population, which is out of control, at least up here where I live, it's out of control. And I try to take advantage of those tools that they offer, but they don't offer. Oklahoma manages a deer overall deer population, and that's what they're concerned with. Because if we don't manage that population, we're going to be out of control. People are hesitant to shoot does, so the state is going to make it easier to shoot bucks, because people will shoot bucks even if it's a 2 or 3-year-old buck. They'll shoot bucks. The state's trying to manage population. As a landowner or as a person that hunts or has access to property or public land, we're the stewards of that land, and we have to make decisions for the best interest of our management goals. And my management goal is to have upper class deer to hunt, but to also have lots of deer that I can take my friends and my family and first time hunters and put them on deer. So that, you know, that's my goal, and I don't want anybody, you know, I don't want them messing with that for sure.
Yeah. And again, I very selfishly asked you that question, because even though I hadn't asked you before or anything, I knew kind of where you stood on it. And it's been about 2 years ago now, but I had the commissioner on, J.D. Strong, and I, you know, that's always a hot topic, so I you know, posed that question to him. And he didn't have the exact number, but he said the amount or the percentage of hunters that actually kill two bucks is in the single digits. Less than 10% of hunters actually kill two bucks every year. And he, again, you know, kind of echoed what you said about the does, you know, the slogan "hunters in the know take a doe." He very much hammered that yes, hunters, just like how most hunters don't shoot two bucks, most hunters also don't shoot two does or even one doe, even though you're allowed, you know, 5 or 6 or whatever. So yeah, I very much agree with you. So that's kind of why I wanted to throw that question out to you. And again, part of my goal here is to get both sides of it. And so I get a lot of one buck advocates, so I wanted to get maybe an anti one buck on too. So, well,
yeah, for sure,
man, I have kept you over an hour now, I think. And so I think I'm just going to have you on again sometime in the next few weeks to talk about your Oklahoma hunting experiences. Cause I do want to talk about those sometimes, but man, I can't thank you enough for coming on and telling us about Kansas and everything. Real quick before I let you go, do you want to shout out your social media real quick, or I don't know if you care or not?
Yeah, I don't really care.
Okay. All right. Well, Tyrell, I look forward to it every year, like I mentioned. Thank you so much for coming on here and sharing your stories and your experience with us. And until next time, we will talk to you later.
Appreciate it, man.
As promised, a nice, long, full, complete episode. So thank you, Tyrell, for coming on. Thank you, folks, for listening. As I mentioned at the beginning, if you have any tips or suggestions for me on Kansas, please hit me up and let me know what you guys think. So I appreciate it. Thank you guys for tuning in. And until next week, I will see y'all right back here on the Oklahoma Outdoors Podcast.